tech team for getting us a new shiny clicker. I'm sure everybody noticed the new clicker. Isn't this nice? An improvement. It's more compact, sleek, aerodynamic. But I want to talk about today, we're going to start right out of the gate, something serious. An internal battle. A struggle that's been going on years, centuries, longer than we've been alive, and will likely go on much longer than we will have on this earth. Together, it is something that pits friend against friend, family against family, even, if you can believe it, enemy against enemy. It's something that gets us right in the pit of our being. And what I'm asking you all here today is, if you can stomach it, join me in this conversation. We're going to have a lively debate, but if you get frisky, Brian, I will make you stay late, and I will talk about the etymology of the word pesto and hospitality, and I will quote The Hobbit to you. All right? So my question. Yes, that's why I married you. Negative? I get a no. Yes. All day, every day with extra ham. No? No, yeah. Oh, I love it. I love it. Donna's never had it. Okay. Bluey. Yeah, you're right. Bluey does like, yes. Wow, good reference. I forgot about that. I like pineapple on pizza. Hopefully it doesn't split up families over this. Okay. You get a beautiful pile of fries. I don't care what they look like. Big wedges, little strings, but they're nice. They're perfect. Where does that ketchup go? If you're out of the fast food, you get those dumb little cups. Okay, fine. Or do you make a neat little on the plate? Or are you some savage cave dweller? And you you cover your fries with ketchup. Oh. Now, there is some young man that grew up in my house, I won't say his initials are GBW, who doesn't like that, but specifically puts ketchup all over his fries to keep others from touching them. Genius. Genius, my son. Stay away from my fries. Okay. I don't care where you put your ketchup. Peanut butter. Chunky. It's like peanut butter with more peanut. What? Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, chunky, crunchy, thank you. Oh, wow, we're going to get... Oh, jeez. Okay, here, Jen, you're going to... Thank you for calling me out. Yeah. I'll take any peanut butter. Donna knows that. She brings cookies and then gets the peanut butter out and sets it there. I'll put peanut... What's that? Creamy, smooth, chunky, crunchy, lumpy... I even buy the natural stuff where the oil all separates and you have to fight to get that oil to the bottom, but I love it. I love peanut butter on just about everything. Beans in your chili? Oh! I know. We all know what Brian's going to say. Go ahead and say poison. Go ahead. Beans in your chili. I don't care. I love chili. Now wait. If it's chicken and it's white chili. Is that still chili? But people call it, what? When does it become a soup? Is cereal soup? I don't know about that. Well, wait, and are hot dogs and tacos, are they the same? Okay, that's not on here, but going local. For those of you watching online, they're not called buffalo wings here. That's redundant. They're just wings. Drum, round, or flat. Any? Oh, wow, round, okay. Yeah, both. Wings, I love them. I can eat them all day, especially if they're scorchingly hot and flames come out my ears. It makes me so happy. And this makes people dining with me so happy to watch me. It's so good. So good. Okay. None of these have divided us yet, really. Boneless wings. They're delicious. I admit I love boneless wings. But okay, on the wing front here, and I spelled it en français. Yes. Ranch or blue cheese? You'd all better say blue cheese. What's that? Okay. Tully's tenders with ranch, pretty good. It's the Asian with ranch. It's you go down just a little south of here, like towards Pennsylvania, and it's all ranch. They're all weird. Oh, blue cheese, the chunkier, the crunchier, the better. I like a good crunchy blue cheese with big chunks of mold in it. Yes, I love it. I love it. Well, thank you for being so amenable to this this eternal struggle, this cosmic battle of differences between food and how we like our food. And then we can go on and on and on and on and on about what we like with our food. But I think this one can draw us together, right? We're not going to quibble over, but what about, maybe. No. Yeah, food. Food is good, right? We're all happy. We see that and we think, ah, and all those meals we've had, those good meals, those delicious burgers and fries and whatever else come flooding back to us. So then, I'm going to add, I'm going to modify this just a hair. See, we can weed out the extroverts and the introverts right here because we got people going, and so, oh yeah, oh, the more the merrier, yes. Food with company is good. And it will be my job today to convince you that, yes, this statement is true, and you can like it, and if you don't, I'll put you in a headlock. But you're going to like this statement. We're going to get to that. But before, so is that really a debate? I don't know. But when we get to the end, hopefully it won't be. And speaking of the end, I'm going to jump to the end, because if you've been paying attention, this is the month 12. That is an even number, and West Middlebury does communion on even-numbered months. So, see, some of you, that means communion will be coming up at the end. And while I speak, I realize a lot of you are going to start putting the pieces together. And I want you to. I want you to have the end of my discussion here in mind. Yes, communion. The things I say, let that, and I'll try to keep the food jokes to a minimum, but let that marinate, okay? Let communion marinate underneath while we go through what we're going to talk about today. Because communion, what is it? What is that thing that we celebrate? Do we pay attention? It is community together celebrating Christ's gift. And sometimes it's a somber occasion. Great, good. Sometimes it's a party. We've done both here. Sometimes it's a celebration outright. We party, and I love that. But what it is that remembrance. But I want to ask, we say the same things with variations every time we do communion of what Jesus said to his apostles, to the disciples there, at their last meal together. He said a lot of things that they didn't understand. Remember when we talked through John, he answered a lot of questions with questions. And he said a lot of things, and they're like, wait, what? And then it became clear afterward. But what he was telling them, what was coming, he wanted them to remember what he did there. He wanted it to remember while they did what? What was the whole command? Remember this while you eat and drink. So, I've entitled today's sermon, Let's Eat. And I love that it worked out that we're doing pastries and prayer a little later, and that it's a communion Sunday, and we're right in the middle of a Thanksgiving and Christmas season where we do a lot of eating and drinking. So, what is going on with all the discussions of food? It is central to the Bible. Has anybody noticed? Has anybody seen that food is everywhere? Well, it is. I'm going to flat out say that. We're going to talk about that quite a bit. But food in the Bible, in the instruction to eat, is a simple one. It's a simple concept, right? It's eat, drink. We have pray, and then there are other things. You know, be healthy, rest, those sorts of things. Those are all simple commands that are in the Bible for all of us. And we tend to complicate them. We always do it. We have all these things that we can say, yeah, I get it. I get what I'm being told to do. Eat. Why is it difficult? Why do we make it so tough? I wonder if perhaps it is the emotions that are the importance of it, the emotions. What makes it so difficult to put it in the perspective of God's command, of a communion, of something special? We have all these notions that are strong, that are part of us, and because food is part of us, we have the need for oxygen, for air, or for our atmosphere, a mix of oxygen and everything else. We have the need for water, right? And then food. Without air, we'll die in a few seconds, a minute or so. Without water, we've got a day or so, too. And food takes a little longer, but that intervening span of time, we're going to get pretty cranky, right? So we have this trifecta of staying alive with air, water, and food. And that food, that very essence of what we need, is the very essence of the Bible. There are other things, but it all surrounds food from beginning to end. You pay attention, and right in the beginning, in Genesis, the Lord God placed the man in the Garden of Eden to tend and watch over it. But the Lord God warned him. That's because, you know, verse 17 is a little more. But you may, this is what he's saying he can do. This is a command. You may freely eat the fruit of every tree. Freely eat every. That's an incredible command because we get stuck on 17 where the Lord says, but there's one tree. So you have all of them except for one. That's what God said. And that was good. The very beginning, God is saying, go eat. And then we jump to Revelation. We have the Spirit and the bride say, come. And let the one who hears say, come. And let the one who is thirsty come. Let the one who desires take the water of life without price. Eat and drink. The bookends to our story, to this, from the story of creation through to the time when Christ returns, we're told, eat and drink. What about the in-between? There's a lot of material in there, a lot of meat in between Genesis and Revelation. We spent a couple of years ago, a whole year observing the Jewish holidays, right? You remember that? We had bonfires, we sang, we camped, we learned, we studied. And what did we find? All those festivals, weeks-long festivals, which are so cool, I wish we could do. Oh, we camped. Did I say that? Stayed in tents, beautiful weather, had a great time. But it all involved food, right? All of those festivals, all of those Old Testament festivals that went on through to Jesus' time and still continue to this day with the Jewish community, we observed, and it was amazing. And just doing a quick search, we find that there are over 1,200 meals mentioned in the Bible. Pretty important, I think. I'm finding a theme here of meals in the Bible. I totally forgot to say. I'm recommending two books from which I've drawn a good amount of material. They're very inspiring. From Tablet to Table, super easy, 162 pages, by Leonard Sweet. Lots of good stuff in here, okay? And then The Gospel Comes with a House Key, about hospitality and letting people into your house. Good books if you want to take pictures of them, borrow them maybe. We'll have to come up with a written agreement on how I'll get them back. But from Tablet to Table, Leonard Sweet quotes a friend. He says he had a friend challenge him and say, bet you I can distill the entire Old Testament into 3 sentences. He says, I'll take that bet, and he did it. He said, they tried to kill us. We survived. Let's eat. That's the Old Testament. There's a lot. They tried to kill us. We tried to kill each other. There was a lot of death. Oh, but we made it. We made it in one form or another. Let's eat. Let's celebrate all of those things. And those meals were ordered in a fashion that brought about remembrance. The food had a point to it. The food had a purpose. There was bitter and there was sweet. And they all remembered where they had been, being in horrible situations, but living through it. And so they ate. So then, clicker's a little behind, sorry. So then we come up to the New Testament. Jesus is on the scene. And what does he do with all of that history? What does, in Luke 34a, the man, the Son of Man, who came eating and drinking, do with all of that? Does he give it up? Does he throw it out? No. He takes that history of eating, of breaking bread together, and fills his gospel with meals. And if you look through the New Testament, Jesus' ministry, he is eating a lot. And I think he walked everywhere because he had to eat off all the meals he was having. Because just in Luke, the Gospel of Luke, 70% of his parables feature food. Jesus ate, and Jesus talked, and Jesus ate, and Jesus partied. One more short list here. We have his first miracle, the wedding in Cana, and I read someone say that it's interesting that they didn't run out of wine until after the apostles showed up. We're not quite sure how much they contributed to that partying, but the party was going to die. Because serving your guests wine was part of the culture. It was imperative that they had wine with their meals. And they asked Jesus, he said, yeah, okay. And he did it. He turned water into wine, and the party kept on going. was his first miracle, to go to a, well, to go to a wedding and party, turn water into wine. And anytime you have a gathering, a large gathering of people, one of the most overlooked things, and usually you have some enterprising person who's done it before who remembers the details, not me, you need potties and food, right? You're going to spend time together in a span of time. If you don't take care of those two things, you're going to lose your people. So Jesus saw that. He's surrounded by a multitude, by 5,000 men. So it could likely have been 10,000 or more people if there was a woman to accompany every man, and we don't count the children either. Thousands and thousands of people gathered to hear him. What did he take care of first? Their bellies. He fed them. Then later on in his ministry, he's walking, and there's Zacchaeus, who was a wee little man. A wee little man was he. I've heard that somewhere. He climbed up in a sycamore tree for the Lord. He wanted to see. He's up there, and Jesus says, Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus is a tax collector. And if you'll remember, we've talked about this, about tax collectors and sinners. They're always lumped together. They're both really bad, and no one liked them. No one wanted a tax collector around because they were very likely taking extra money, skimming off the top, and they were working for the Romans, for the government that they didn't want in place. No one liked them. And because he was a little guy, he had to see Jesus. He had to see what was going on, and Jesus knew he was there, and he said, hey, I don't know if he called him little guy. Maybe he called him big guy to make him feel good. Hey, big guy, we're going to go to your house and eat. We're going to go eat together at your house. And people saw Jesus doing that. And you'll see the theme here. He's doing all these things. Everybody's scratching their head wondering, what is going on, Jesus? So I have two things here, Emmaus and post-resurrection. The road to Emmaus, after his resurrection, we've got two disciples, despondent, sad, upset. Things didn't work out the way they thought they were going to work out. Jesus is gone. Jesus is dead. And someone shows up, and they talk, and they discuss, and they invite this unknown person to eat. And it wasn't until, so their eyes became clear. They saw who they were talking to after they ate. And then Jesus is on the shore there. Disciples, Simon Peter, they're out in the boat fishing, and they see Jesus. And Simon Peter is so excited that he jumps from the boat because Jesus is doing what? I mean, it's Jesus. He's excited to see Jesus. But Jesus is there, and he says, hey, who's up for breakfast, right? Who wants to eat together? And then the one I'm most excited for. Heavenly banquet. That is incomprehensible how amazing it's going to be. Because we can think about all the great things. We can think about all the great restaurants we've been to and all the great food and meals we've had together. But someday we'll be having a heavenly banquet. And Isaiah, sorry, this is so small. In Jerusalem, the Lord of heaven's armies will spread a wonderful feast for all the people of the world. It will be a delicious banquet with clear, well-aged wine and choice meat. There he will remove the cloud of gloom, the shadow of death that hangs over the earth. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away all tears. He will remove forever all insults and mockery against his land people. The Lord has spoken. We're going to have a feast. I don't know how long that feast will last. Maybe it's eternity. But it's going to be great. And I wish the Geithner's out there because Ben already answered my question. Anybody take French? French to eat? Manger, right? You haven't put that together. Jesus was literally put in a feeding trough. He started his life here on earth in a manger where food would have been served. I didn't realize manger and manger to eat until I was much too old to realize that. But his entire ministry from beginning to end, remember, we're going to head to that communion together. That Last Supper was food. He showed us that the table is sacred. It's not just for popping your rear ends down and wolfing down food. The table is sacred. And even the secular world realizes this. We have an author, George Meyerson. He wrote a book, 200-some pages long, A Private History of Happiness, and I read every page. I didn't. But somebody distilled it down to his conclusion. He wrote, "We're happiest among friends, gathered around tables, with good food, conversation, and laughter." He did an extensive study and came down to that truth. And that is a truth that is in us. We can't argue that. It is something that seems to be in our very cells, in our very being, that we gather together, we enjoy good food, we laugh, and we talk, and we get to know each other. There's more information here from the secular world that I wanted to read. We go on. There was another study by a sociologist named Cody Delastrati, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, that he wrote for a scientific literature, and he discovered proof that the loss of the table has had quantifiable negative effects, both physically and psychologically. Here's what he found. And if you want the resources on all the sources on all this, I can give them to you. He found the number one factor for parents raising kids who are drug-free, healthy, intelligent, kind human beings, frequent family dinners. The number one shaper of vocabulary in younger children, even more than any other family event, including play, frequent family dinners. The number one predictor of future academic success for elementary age children, you guessed it, frequent family dinners. One of the best safeguards against childhood obesity, eating meals together. The best prescription to prevent eating disorders among adolescent girls, frequent family dinners that exude a positive atmosphere. And the variable most associated with lower incidence of depressive and suicidal thoughts among 11 to 18 year olds, as you guessed it, frequent family dinners. The secular world realized it. The secular world notices it. And I'm ashamed to say I'm not that great at it. And I don't know how easy it is for all of you to do this. This isn't easy. And it gets more and more difficult with our world, with how things change and how we live our lives and what's expected of us. What's expected of us for events to stay busy, to get things done, to not rest. But there is mountains of evidence to show how important this is. And Jesus knew it. Jesus lived it. And we come here, right, to learn about Jesus. We come here with the point, the hope, the desire, the intent that every day, every time we spend time together, every time we spend time in the Word, every time we encourage each other, every time we learn and sing and grow, we want to be more like Jesus. And so, without overcomplicating it, what did Jesus really do? He ate good food with bad people. Now, since we don't have Jesus here to eat with us, that seems to be like just bad people eating good food together, right? That's who we are. His example was sit down and have a meal together. But what he did in doing that, what happened was, is this is the second half of that verse where I chopped off when he comes eating and drinking. They said, look, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors. So he didn't just simply sit down with his buddies and yuck it up and have a great time and talk about sports. He invited Zacchaeus. He invited prostitutes. He invited sinners and tax collectors. He invited people that would otherwise be alone, would never know Jesus. And I'm happy that last week it worked out really well. Pastor Kyle didn't know what I was going to talk about. Audrey didn't know what I was going to talk about. In Mark 2, we read, Mark 2:15, and as he reclined at the table in his house, many tax collectors and sinners were reclining with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. Jesus sat down with sinners. Jesus sat down and became one of them. At that time, the culture to sit down and eat a meal together, to be a companion, to have company, was almost like family. It was saying, I am your friend. We are tight. You are important. We are close now. The word, here's my only one, I think, that I'll give a word origin. Two words, company, kumpane or panis, bringing bread. And companion? One who brings bread. He was companions. They brought bread together. They broke bread. They had meals. He sat down. And in that same quote from Leonard Sweet's friend, he condensed the New Testament to Jesus' message. I love you. I forgive you. Let's eat. And I love it. I love it. Because we can't question, what do I do? Where do I start? What did Jesus do? Jesus sat down and ate food with his friends, his enemies. I mean, they had to be there. I mean, they didn't all end up liking him. And I think we can do that, right? When we sit down, when we break bread or break meat or have a drink together, we're finding ourselves with our friends, with our companions, with our company that's there. And being at that table, our real selves start to come to the surface. Our real selves are there with friends, and we are learning, and we are growing, and that truth is coming out. The truth of ourselves, the truth from our friends. Again, Audrey didn't know what I was going to talk about, but she ended last week with a story of having a friend over. And that friend didn't know her very well, I gather, because Audrey said, I got to bounce. I have to go to church for the evening service. And they had been sitting around their table, and that friend said, oh, you're one of those people. Well, in that moment, I don't know if that would have ever happened if Audrey hadn't invited that friend into her home, hadn't said, you are equal, let's sit down. And I'm telling you who I am. And so that gave the opportunity for her friend to say who she was. And she said, you know what, I don't think you're going to like me because of who I'm associated with. You know, many people down the association line, but it was enough that she worried that Audrey wasn't going to like her. Well, that's very telling. To make that statement, ooh, you're not going to like me, takes a comfort level. And that opened the door for Audrey to say, you know what? I don't care. I love you. You may not have said, I love you. I don't know. But by mere virtue of being together, eating together, being at a table together, said, we're friends. We can talk. And I repeat, the table is sacred. Because when we are telling the truth, and when we are hearing the truth, becomes a sacred moment. There's nothing like it. I could go on and on and on, and I had to stop myself from going on and on and on because there's so much truth in all of this. So, can you deny it? Afterward, if you want to deny it with me, let me know. We can talk about it. Because this is not an easy one. We're going to step outside of our comfort zones. If we're going to have people who might not look like our family, or might not have the same culture around the table. People who might eat with their forks in the wrong hands, or not know how to use chopsticks. I don't know, but they're going to come into your house. I picked an obscure one there. They're going to come into your house, and their culture might change the vibe. Right? It's easy having dinner with your buddies or your family, and you know what annoys each other, or the sound of chewing, or all that sort of stuff. But you have somebody in who's not like you. That's tough. But that's what Jesus did. What do our tables look like? We've got a lot of them. And this is, again, just a small list. Official, that says ladies night. That's supposed to be ladies. We have our potlucks. I love our potlucks. If you've grown up with a church, potlucks are amazing. Some people don't like them. That's okay. We've got our small groups. Some small groups eat. Some don't. Some do sometimes. If they don't, bring food. Eat together. Got our men's small group too. Includes a wrench club. Our table is sometimes a junky, rusty car in the middle with a pizza on it. But that works. It works really well. And we've gotten to know each other. It's around tables that I've gotten to know a lot of you. And I'm thankful for that. Find out what you like and what you don't like, food-wise, otherwise, car-wise, anything. And that's where that truth comes out. Ladies' nights, and plug for Audrey. She's been doing a great job. together events for females to be together and to talk and be companions. But I ask you to invite people to these, to open that sacred table up to those that are around you. Finally, communion, and I'm going to ask the musicians to come up because we're going to do things a little out of order. Sorry, everybody. We have communion. And this is our table to remember. This is our table where God ordained, a God-commanded ceremony. He said, whenever you eat and drink, remember my sacrifice for you. So we're going to move into communion here, and we're going to start with our first song. So if you want to stand, new song alert. My usual warnings.